When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello, everyone. It is the Red Men Originals podcast with me, Paul Machin. This man alongside me is Chris Pager. That wonderful woman over there is Chloe Bloxham. That other amazing man right there is Dan Club. I am in a stellar mood today. I'm tired, but I am in a stellar mood. And I have been since the full-time whistle went at Anfield. Because I just genuinely love the football team that we support. It's great. We're going to be talking about Liverpool's draw with Manchester City, the impact on the Premier League title race. We're going to be looking back at the week that was and ahead to the week that hopefully will be for Liverpool with two more games to be played this week because that just never stops. But I just want to remind you guys, we have got some events coming up, live events. So if you're in a good mood, if the Reds have got you in a stellar mood as well and you want to come and celebrate that good mood with us in person, we're in Belfast and Dublin. It's 2 weeks.
We need to get planning.
Yeah.
We sold a lot of tickets. We cannot disappoint.
Yeah. No, well, we won't. It'll be fine.
I don't know, Paul. It's the story of my life.
Well, no, you don't know whether you've disappointed enough.
I do.
You
never tells me on the time.
It's out, it's out. Yeah, I haven't sold tickets. Chris has disappointed in the bedroom, but never in a live show. Never before in his life. Depends what your expectations are.
One time in Amsterdam. Anyway.
If you want to be entertained, then Chris Pedek has got you back. We've got Keo with us as well, of course, is the singing sensation. He's going to be performing Liverpool hits for us to have a good sing along to. But yeah, we're in Belfast on the 24th of March. We're in Dublin on the 25th of March. You can get them from ticketmaster.ie. And then another month later, on the 24th of April, we are in London. You can go to axs.com. Just type in Red Men TV. You can type that on the Ticketmasters as well. And come and see us. We're at the Indigo at the O2. So basically, the Millennium Dome, for anyone old enough, we're there. We're playing the Millennium Dome. Like so much bad edutainment in the early 2000s. We're going to be there, except there will be a harder edge to what we're doing. Because...
it's what I do.
Because what he does, it's what he brings. So yeah, please do go and grab your tickets, obviously, particularly for the Belfast and the Dublin. They're fast approaching. So you're just thinking, I wasn't sure if the Reds were going to be shite or not, whether I want to be happy. Well, no, the Reds are mustard, and we're going to have a very, very good time with you guys over there. So yeah, go and grab your tickets while you can. So, okay. Everyone okay?
I'm sweet, man.
Right, should we do it? Should we talk? Liverpool 1, Man City 1.
Please.
Christopher Pajac. Like, I don't know how, we've not spoken about the game at all. I was just, again, buzzing, so elated. And it's mad that I'd have been more so if we'd won the game, of course. But it's mad to come out of a game where Liverpool basically missed out on the opportunity to go back top of the league, and yet I still feel like I'm absolutely on cloud nine because I was so pleased with the performance. How did you feel about the game?
I think I felt angry after the game, to be honest with you. Obviously, I wasn't there yesterday, and I think had you been there, you get to soak up the atmosphere, you know, more, but actually also you just get to soak up the atmosphere. Didn't get to do that. Obviously, got to hear it on the television and stuff like that. So I think I was just annoyed at the referee come the end of the game, to be honest with you. And it felt to me like, it felt like 2 points dropped at the end of the game because of something that wasn't in our control. And I think over that's softened over the last sort of 24 hours, where I've come to the conclusion that, like, we're absolutely amazing. And I knew this yesterday.
Yeah.
And now I just don't think it matters anymore what the referee did in that game.
Yeah.
So I'm really, really, really buzzing for the next games. And, you know, I'm absolutely gutted in some ways that we do have to wait, you know, was it like 20 odd days or something like that to get back in the Premier League, because I just want it more. And I want those days to just go quickly, and I want those games just to win those games and stuff. But I truly believe that Liverpool can win the league this season.
Yeah.
Like, massively so.
Yeah. That is exactly why I was so happy walking out of it. I don't know what you, Chloe, because that was that general sense of, we've had loads of games where it's like, this might define how it's going to give us information about Liverpool, and we've drawn pretty much all of them. We drew this one as well, and yet I actually got the information that I was looking for, that Liverpool are more than capable of challenging for the title.
Yeah, the fight shown was absolutely ridiculous. You've got to look at that side. That's a side that, you know, before kickoff when the team news comes out, I think Manchester City are licking the lips. They're going, they're missing about five unbelievable starters here who would slot straight into their team. And what Liverpool did was they worked themselves into the game. Look, Manchester City at times had moments. Of course, they were going to have moments, the Manchester City. But Liverpool grew into that game. And that second half, we blew them away. We should have won. We just weren't clinical enough, to be perfectly honest. But coming out of that game, all I could do was praise the performance, praise the attitude, praise the hard work, the grit. That is a Manchester City team, their best Manchester City team. And we, in that second half, ripped them apart. They were hoofing balls up the pitch at Anfield. They were petrified. And yeah, look, we were unlucky to not maybe, you know, get the winner. And they did ultimately hit the post in the last, you know, minute of the 90. But I just walked out there thinking, this is a Liverpool side that if they play like this for the next 10 Premier League games, they can beat absolutely everyone, and they can wipe the floor with a lot of teams if they produce things like that.
Yeah. What about you, Dan?
No, unbelievable. Yeah, I was properly buzzing after it, to be honest with you. Just heartened by all of it, because, you know, in spite of what Conor Bradley and Joel Quanta have done in recent weeks, use those two as examples in amongst all. And Chloe's right, there's so many key absentees. And I think if you flipped it the other way and sort of taken five or six of Man City's key players out with their team, they wouldn't put a side out anything like ours, or they certainly won't compete in the same manner which we've been doing. So that's one thing in itself. But again, as good as those two individuals have been in recent weeks, if you'd have told me back in September you'd be starting a game against Manchester City at home at Anfield with Conor Bradley and Joel Quanta, I'd have gone, oof, this could be problematic. Not a bit of it. Absolutely exceptional. Unbelievable. And again, the character, the grit, the quality, the spirit, all of those adjectives. But above all else, like, the quality, moreover. Yeah. Like, how good we were. Not only did we compete with them, we were better than them in pretty much every single department, apart from probably the first 10 minutes and maybe another spell further down the line. But overall, for the majority of that game, we were the better team, and we were in the ascendancy, we were on the front foot. So honestly, I was so elated with the display, and it gave me so much cause for optimism moving forward. I'm like you, Chris, I just can't wait to get playing footy again, whether it be Thursday, Premier League matters, whatever. What we've got at the minute just feels so special, and it feels like it's building to this crescendo at the end of it. I just want to see what comes next, essentially. It's just incredible times.
Yeah, exactly that. I had this moment, and I don't know whether anyone else was like this in old school Chapmans, but there's a point in the game where you look at your fixture list and it all fits on one screen, and that's when you know you're in the final stretch, and it's like, okay, cool, this is it now. And like, we're basically like, that's where we're at now. Liverpool are, and look, if we get through Europa League and FA Cup, then that will extend a bit, of course, and great, let's hope it does. But I'm in it now. It's like, it's a handful of months now until we get to the summer. We're going to know the outcome before we know it. It's mad that they've come to this point of the season. It's just exciting. Like, yeah. And again, it's been a wild week on my perspective, which I will talk about a bit later on. But the what Dan says there, Chris, this is the thing. We were better than Man City for huge portions of that game. And this isn't just bias. This is like, Man City have admitted this. Pep Guardiola said this. He talked about like it being 20 minutes maybe where they were good, and then that was basically it. John Stones has talked about it. Like, a lot of their players have come out and said very similar. We had Kelleher in goal, and he's been boss. We had Bradley at right back. We had Joel Quanta at centre back. I mean, again, Joel Quanta 21, Conor Bradley 20, Harvey Elliott 20. There was nine lads who conceivably could have at least taken a place on the bench, still out injured for us as well. That's not meant to happen. That should have been a backs of the wall performance, where City, who were only missing Jack Grealish, should have come there, and that was their time to shine. and it wasn't. They very nearly got the biggest hiding that they've had there in a long time.
They did, and you know, I think when it comes down to it, you've got to praise Klopp as well as each and every one of the players, because listen, if it was me in charge, I'd have got Mo Salah on that pitch from the start, and yet he has instilled this sort of trust and belief into every player that it doesn't matter if Mo's out anymore. And, you know, we've been forged in fire the last few weeks, haven't we? And we've come out stronger off the back of it. You can see that. And, like, there's a point now where I'm looking at this side and thinking to myself about the side that, you know, happened in previous years, where, you know, you've got Gini Wijnaldum, you've got Jordan Henderson, you've got Fabinho, you've got Firmino, you've got Mane, you've got Salah and all these lads. And I'm looking at this going, this is the start of a journey for this group. And I'm looking at this like, is the ceiling for this team, this squad of players, better? Because it could be. Like, and that's what yesterday gave me.
Yeah.
It gave me that belief that we've got the next lads already in, yeah, and we're going to see over the next year or 2 years, and we might win it in the first year of this side.
Yeah.
And that's now where I'm looking at it going, I don't think we can be stopped.
Yeah,
I don't. I think Klopp's instilled that into every single one of them.
Yeah, that's the thing about the Bradley and Quanta thing in particular. And again, in addition to the goalie, Chloe, is that you get to a point where it's been fine. I think you can muddle through a season, you know, game by game and on adrenaline and good tactics and, you know, and a few good moments. But the Nottingham Forest one was quite telling the other week, where sometimes if you take too many of the good lads out, it just makes it harder work. So that was the acid test, I thought, for Kelleher, for Quanta, for Bradley, and even for Elliot to some extent, even though obviously he's now been playing big games of football for us for a couple of years. And that, at Chris's point, I think is spot on there. This is a very, very young team, and they're capable of doing that now. That is frightening.
Yeah, and look, this is the game of the Premier League. This is the one that everyone's been looking to. Liverpool v Manchester City at Anfield in that unbelievable atmosphere. And for those lads to not just put out the performance that they did, but to not, you know, cower under pressure. They were wanting the ball, Quanta on the ball, playing out from the back, wasn't scared of the press that Manchester City was setting. Conor Bradley, you know, was really, he pocketed Alvarez. I thought he was brilliant defensively, but going forward, he also helped us out as well on the counter a couple. And yeah, it's mad to see that these young lads, who you should think should never be able to go out against a top City side and actually be better than them, they were being, you know, counting up and being some of the best players. Quanta and Virgil van Dijk had the best striker in football right now up against them, and I didn't hear a peep out of the lads. I hardly saw them. Kelleher again steps up in massive moments, the Phil Foden in the second half, but also their first 5-10 minutes they were better than us, and they had a chance from the right hand side, and Kelleher could so easily just not collect the ball, and if Phil Foden's right there in front of him, but instead he manages to calm us down and get the ball and keep us going. And yet for those lads to come out and produce a performance like that, to have the quality that they had, and also to deal with the atmosphere and how big of the moment in the game it was, it goes to show that, you know, there is no limits for these lads, because if they're doing it already at the top against, for me, you know, potentially the greatest side the Premier League has ever seen, for them to do that against them at the ages of 19, 20 is absolutely ludicrous.
And Chloe's right, isn't it? Because we've seen this Liverpool side with these players come back against sides. Luton's the perfect example of that. This is the acid test, as you say. This is Manchester City. Mm. It's all well and good. Are you good enough to do it against Luton at home? And they were. But that could have been 4-1 to us. Yeah. You know, had we just been a little bit better last night?
Well, when you're scraping wins against Nottingham Forest in 99th minute, we were all jubilant, elated. Like, it was an amazing moment. But that goes one of two ways. You're either about to collapse, or it's a sign of we're so good that we can win no matter what the circumstances. That's what was great about City. It was like picking that up and going, no, it was that we're really good.
Yeah, and you've made the best manager probably in a lot of people's eyes in world football go 4-4-2 and take off one of the best footballers that I've ever seen in Kevin De Bruyne and bring on a yard dog and Kovacic, because they cannot get to grips with what we're doing at the time. And that tells me that, you know, the tide just changed completely. Yeah. And he was playing for a draw at the end of the game, and Liverpool were playing for a win. And if you'd have asked him at the start of the game whether he thought that would be the case, he wouldn't have believed it. He would not have believed that he'd have to do that in that game. That was never a sub that was pre-planned.
And I think just to continue on the theme about Guardiola, you could tell how rattled he was by the whole thing, Dan, because he was asked about the atmosphere again, and he went on this like long tirade about how, oh well, you know, Liverpool have never won at the Etihad, which is wrong, by the way. Now, and of course, I've seen Man City fans going, in the Premier League, and it's like, it's not what he said. He said never, and I've literally been in the building while we've won there and knocked them out the Champions League on the way as well. One of the most stressful, horrendous experiences I've ever had in a football ground. But this is the thing, he was, once again, you know, we had something that he, and we always seem to have something that he can't manage to replicate.
Yeah.
He wants the ball, great, you know, have the ball, we'll just boo the life out of you. I saw Rodri shitting his pants and giving the ball away on the edge of the 18-yard box.
Yeah.
It spoke to how rattled all of Manchester City was.
Yeah, certainly second half. And as you say, it's players, it's seasoned professionals, it's players at the very top, at the very peak of their powers, who you wouldn't normally associate that sort of thing with. They're the lads who are normally calm under pressure. They've been in most atmospheres, they've been in most situations and overcome it. But for whatever reason, Pep and his players can't handle Anfield. It's as simple as that. When Anfield's at its feral, fever pitch best, Man City crumble time and time again. Whether it be Pep's decision making gets a little bit clouded and he does things he doesn't normally do, whether it's headed into games, he makes silly decisions ahead of Liverpool because we get in his mind beforehand, who knows? But whatever it is, Liverpool have this impact on Pep Guardiola and Man City, moreover. And yesterday, it was never been more evident than yesterday. We've beaten, we've put them to the sword at Anfield before, certainly the Champions League games, so the 4-3 and stuff like that. I've never seen a Man City side play as badly as what you've seen yesterday. For that second 45 in particular, they were all over the place. We were all over them. We were feral. We were carving them open. Even in games whereby we beat them, we've never been that rampant against Man City in my mind.
They kept trying to slow the game down by, you know, slowing the throw-ins down, throwing a ball here and there. You know, Edison stays on the pitch and then ultimately goes down. And I think it's like, great, this is a little moment for us to try and regain control again. But what you actually saw was, that's all right, lads. We know your goalkeeper's about to come off and he's one of the best goalkeepers. And Anfield took it as a sign to uplift us even more. That in the break, even we could see that they were trying to, you know, do these stoppages. That's fine. You do that and we'll go one step further. We'll go even louder and we'll make sure that our players don't, you know, get cold for the next couple of seconds. We'll fight for them. They could not. That second half, the way the atmosphere was for, you know, after Darwin Nunes wins the penalty, it's unbelievable. I'd be surprised if those lads could have heard themselves on the pitch. Like you said there, Rodri is the best DM in world football for me. And he was on the ropes. He was too scared to make a pass. He was too scared to have the ball. That's Rodri.
Yeah, and this goes back to the whole their tactics and whatever. I want to ask the question of you guys. What was your favourite thing about the game? And I just want to start because it ties into it and how it goes back to the start of this sort of conversation. The subbing Kevin De Bruyne thing and seeing him, because his head went about 5 minutes before. I don't know if it was caught on the TV cameras, but there was a misplaced pass and he just did like the arms to the head, arms to the sky. And I'm like, I was like, there we go, got you. We've got your ear, mate. And I know because I've seen Kevin De Bruyne lose his head at Anfield so many times over the years. It's normally followed by Pep, but actually Pep at least managed to keep his cool this time around, which is probably why they didn't totally and utterly capitulate. But I genuinely love that as a moment. I get you first, Chris, but yeah, let us know if you're watching. What was your favourite thing about the Liverpool-Man City game?
I think, to be honest with you, you know, I saw the question on the agenda and we've kind of discussed what my favourite thing was already. So I'll sort of change it and I'll say maybe, you know, the fact that we dominated the midfield battle is for me the key for this game. And I think, you know, over the course of maybe the last two or three seasons, I thought Pep Guardiola has gotten better and better at beating Liverpool and dominating the games, and it's become more Man City. It, you know, the pendulum swung from us to them, and for us to dominate that midfield when you've got Bernardo Silva, who was anonymous, and he's one of the best against us year in, year out. When Kevin De Bruyne is almost anonymous, and when Rodri is doing what Chloe's already mentioned, Fernando, McAllister and Szoboszlai to come in there and absolutely dominate, and latterly then Elliot go into the midfield and us continue to dominate, play through the middle against them, play through their press, watch our team grow throughout the game from that first 10 minutes of shit, they're everywhere, we can't get out to, oh God, this is easy. We just pop, 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 ladder passes through the centre, little bounce passes left and right, and you're on goal and stuff. To see that within a 90-minute spell from going, we can't do it, to we've got your pants down here, lads, and you can't stop us, was just unbelievable. And the second thing, please indulge me, I'm going to put it on the screen right now, is this Manchester City fan at the top corner in the yellow, pointing to McAllister behind the goal, where the goal is. Thank you very much, you fucking idiot. He pointed for 10 seconds of the build-up to the penalty where the goal was, and Alexis went, yeah, thanks, mate, here it is.
Yeah, big fan of that. Big fan.
What a novice.
What a novice. So, have you stood behind the goal? Or even if you're the goalie?
Do this, do anything distracted. Don't tell him where the goal is.
But what's he... Because ultimately, let's be honest, when you're that far... Because this guy in his yellow jersey is like... He's what, like 5 metres to the side of the goal? So if he's trying to point to a side of the goal to tell us... he's not. He's pointing at both sides of the goal because they are both in that general direction. Wild. What is he, I don't know,
bring it back up for us, Aaron. Look at the state of him.
There's the goal.
There was on video as well, there was a few trying to record it, and their face was just a picture when the phones went down. That'll never see the light of day.
Yeah.
unless it's a City fan against Tottenham in the Champions League who put the vlog out.
City fans do a lot of that as well. Like, they had that one where, is it Mahrez missed the penalty and they put the video out of themselves watching that. Wild. Absolutely wild. Chloe, what was your favourite thing about the game?
There were so many things to love, but
what was your favourite thing?
The fight, the effort, the pressing, the way if someone was beaten, it's all right because Virgil van Dijk ran 60 yards back to win a tackle. And when I tell you, it was louder than when we scored the goal. I mean, it was louder than when we scored the goal.
Was that the sliding?
Yeah, it was the slide where he and Phil Foden goes to rattle someone and then realises it's Virgil van Dijk and is like, actually, lad, yeah, well done, lads. Yeah, see you later.
Van Dijk doesn't even look at him. He goes to square up, doesn't he? And Van Dijk just carries on, and as he walks past, he pats him on the back.
It was just a fight. The tackles going in from Bradley in the first half, from loads of players. And every time, you know, we won the ball back high up, the crowd reacted to it. We were on our feet, and that happened several times. And it also ended up in them booting balls in the second half. The one from Kevin De Bruyne, it might have been just after we'd scored. He receives it in the middle of the park, and he literally just hits it along the floor to our goalkeeper. No one in sight. Yeah. And he was like, get this ball away from me. And to put that fear into potentially, you know, the greatest team in Europe right now is a bit ridiculous.
Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, similar really for me, as Chloe says, to terrify world-class football players in the manner that we did is testament to just how good we were. But a couple for me, I think the youngsters, we've already mentioned, passing with flying colours, that's a really nice thing to have come out of a game of such a magnitude and such a stern test as well. But in terms of sort of individual moments, I only seen this after the game, and me and Chris were panicking before the penalty near about the wait and the legs. I never like waiting for penalties. It's not a nice feeling. Obviously, Ederson being down. And I seen a clip from the cop where McAllister's base is doing keep you up on the edge of the box whilst he was waiting. It's like, I wish I'd have known you were doing that whilst we were waiting.
I'd have felt a lot better.
That would have calmed me down a hell of a lot. Yeah, so that would have been one of them. Louis Diaz's run as well from left back to left wing, that was a moment as well. Absolutely loved that. And also, I've got a special mention for Wataru Endo taking the ball off Kevin De Bruyne and then just saying, see you later, mate. And Kevin De Bruyne basically gave up at that point as well. Kind of, that's that then. And for someone, you know, 60 million bargain this season for me, Wataru Endo, to do that to somebody of Kevin De Bruyne's ilk was really special.
Yeah, absolutely. Just glorious. Yeah,
was yours to Kevin De Bruyne?
So, yeah, because that's a huge indicator of how the game's going. But there was one, I put it out on my Instagram before, but it was the warm-ups where everyone's dead stressed and you've got Mo Salah and Tsimikas and Robbo on the bench doing the rondos, and the Salah got stitched up and ends up in the middle and bike by Tsimikas, and then maybe gets megged by Robbo, but not quite, and then Tsimikas absolutely plants one on him and they all erupt and start jumping around him, and Tsimikas is picking him up, and I'm like, this is the biggest game of the season. All the pressure's on here. And our lads are megging each other and fucking laughing their heads off like it's just a run around in the park or whatever. I love stuff like that. I love it. Right, let's talk about some of the incidents and performances from the game itself. I thought it was a really interesting one. I tried to figure out that. I presume they won the toss because obviously we attacked the Annie Road end, and it felt, Chris, like Gengo Batapep being rattled and all. They were trying every little trick in the book, everything they can to try and take it. And it meant that
It's at the cop end.
They flipped it around. So we had to sack the cop and first half rather than second half, which annoys the life out of me because basically I had no idea that there was any controversy in the game whatsoever because so much of it happened down the far end of the pitch. But it was a bright start from City. But even when they got the goal, which felt like it came out of nowhere, I felt like we were in the game at half time. I don't know about you.
Yeah, no, the first 10 minutes, it was complete and utter domination from City, as far as I understood it. You know, we couldn't get out from the back. We were struggling, but they never gave up. And then we just clawed and sort of fought our way into the game and then just wrestled it off them. And then for the next 20, up until their goal, probably, we were the dominant side. And, you know, it looked like, you know, Darwin Nunes managed to stay onside. We'd have gone 1-0 up ourselves. I thought it was a brilliant ball by McAllister to spot Darwin Nunes making a good run. Unfortunately, he was offside. He does the right thing, plays in Luis Diaz. When the goal goes in, it's against the run of play. Yeah. And then we just go, fucking hell, this is going to be a long slog now. And almost instantaneously, our lads went, no, it's not. We're all right. We're in this. And then from there till half-time, it was all Liverpool again. And again, when you think about the young players that we've got, to be able to just brush that off, pick yourselves up and get back into the game straight away, it's just a testament to who these lads are and what they can achieve.
I think it helped, Dan, that as the half wore on, Szoboszlai figured out what he was meant to be doing.
Yeah.
And it was by the end of the half, he was getting into the box. He was actually supporting the attack a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And it meant that...
Was that header first?
He had that header in there, yeah. I was going to say, yeah.
He needs to hit the target.
He's... Because obviously the problem with Harvey Elliott playing in the front three is that ultimately he's not Mo Salah and he's not going to get into as many goal scoring situations. So you need one of your midfield to go and increase the numbers. And that happened more and more and more. And he was being more aggressive in how he pressed, higher and higher up the pitch. And we were just, we sowed the seeds, I think, for the second half performance long before the second half actually kicked off.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I was relatively sort of content at halftime, despite being 1-0 down. I agree with you. I felt like we were very much in the game and we'd gone, you know, more or less blow for blow for Man City in that first half. And we'd shown enough in that first 45 minutes to say to me that we're more than worthy or more than capable of getting back into it and getting a result, because I thought we were outstanding at a certain point of the game. I think Szoboszlai, it was an interesting one because for the first sort of 20 odd minutes, despite Liverpool getting better within that time period, it felt like it was a game that suited him because there was quite a lot of open space. Once we'd broken their press, it felt like Szoboszlai should be influencing the game more, but for whatever reason, he just wasn't. He was a little bit anonymous, he wasn't getting the ball that much. But then, as you say, he grew into the first half and definitely felt like Liverpool were building towards something as the first half came to a close. And despite not getting back on level terms in that period, I was at the break, despite being 1-0 down and obviously Man City's powers and all that sort of stuff, I was thinking, no, we're all right here. We've shown to me that we've got the quality, we've got the capability to hurt these second half. I didn't expect us to be as brilliant as we were second half, by the way.
Well,
that
you put a tweet
me
out at half time that says, we're all right here, decent half.
Yeah.
Get a goal back and bring Mo on.
Yeah.
And
that was my.
It went exactly like that. I watched you type the tweet, and about 2 minutes in, we've got one on.
I think I turned to you and said something along those lines as well. Like, say, if we can get the leveler before sort of the hour mark and then introduce Mo, that's the And it felt like that was possible. It wasn't just me saying it for the sake of it. It felt like that was going to happen in a way.
And that was there, the game plan was there, spelled out from minute one. The second they started Kevin De Bruyne and we didn't start Salah, you're like, at some point these are basically going to shake hands as one walks off the pitch and the other walks on, and City are going to have to cope with not having Kevin De Bruyne on the pitch whilst also coping with having to go against Mohamed Salah,
retired legs and stuff like that
exactly that.
I would have brought him on at half time personally.
Mo,
you did say that.
I would have definitely brought him on at half time if you could,
but I felt like the lad, to come back to what we just talked about, I felt like the 11 that started the game, again, to a risk of repeating myself, had shown enough to warrant getting that next 15 minutes. I felt like we were good, really good at times, so I was okay with it.
I agree with that. And it's like anything, to let the lads figure it out on the pitch. And, you know, there's clearly more to play. Because just to jump ahead, we'll talk about the substitutions, Chloe. The problem was with us is that it was great to have those players back, and the squad that we had available to us looked so much better than it did 2 weeks ago. But this was a week too soon for this game for us, really, because all of a sudden, yes, Mohamed Salah's coming on, but you can see he's miles off it. You know, he's still a threat, he's still a danger, but that's not super sharp Mo Salah running in ready to kill a game of football off. And when you're then taking Darwin Nunez off, because you've got to be careful with Darwin Nunez and Cody Gakpo, you know, we've had like 3 weeks worth of conversations on him now. He's not totally bang on it. We probably strengthened in terms of just legs in some regard, but yeah, that was us. Yeah, so we had to be careful with Szoboszlai, we had to be careful with Salah, we had to be careful with Nunez, and that's a knock-on impact of having so many players out for so long.
Yeah, it is. Like you mentioned there, look, Salah comes on and I'm thinking, this is boss, this. He does that unreal ball to Luis Diaz and I'm like, right lads, another 30 minutes of this please. And he kind of fades, you don't really see him with the ball at his feet. There's one chance where he's offside for it, where he shouldn't really be offside, and he wasn't sharp enough, and that's just what happens when a lad's not been playing for 2-3 weeks. And yeah, you could tell when he came on, and it's kind of a, but if we could have just, you know, played this weekend and he'd have got maybe 45 or 60 at Sparta Prague at home, then maybe he'd have been a bit more sharp for it. But he wasn't. And it goes to show, though, that like if he was on top form, just imagine what we could have done, because we were all over them. As for Dom, like he's mentioned there, he started, but he wasn't great. He had to grow into the game and he had moments, but ultimately you have to be safe with him. And also it wasn't like we could really make any other choice from the off, so we kind of had to start. And Darwin Nunez, I was distraught when Darwin Nunez came off the pitch, and it felt like it inside the stadium. Everyone was fuming with the amount of times he was offside, but as soon as you took him off the pitch, everyone went, oh, like the excitement's gone. The if there's anyone I want running in behind, it's him.
Well, and it's when the flip reverse of Forest the other week, isn't it? Where you're taking off that guy who's just going to stretch things and excite you and get your bum off your seat. And that's the pity. And ultimately, Luis Diaz carried that mantle pretty well in and of himself. But yeah, that was a little bit of an undercutting thing. And look, the aura of Mohamed Salah on the pitch, Chris, is going to help, because he's just going to draw attention, he's going to draw people towards him. But yeah, you can't help but just be like, oh, imagine if we just had a good run there with a fully fit and sharp Darwin and Mohamed Salah.
Yeah, we'd have beaten him, we'd have snotted them, actually, to be honest with you. I think I just love the way that like this Liverpool side, I've sort of been thinking about this more and more, like, you know, the late winners and all that type of stuff, and the way the City attacked us early doors, tried to take the fans out of it, tried to dominate the game. It's almost like two heavyweight boxers, isn't it? But one's a little bit overweight and needs to get it done in the first couple of rounds and a knockout. And Liverpool are just approaching games like it's a points decision. We're going to go 12 rounds with you and we're going to catch you late on and stuff like that. And that's what we've seen over and over, and isn't it? And Salah was part of that. He was part of that final flurry of big hits that you want to be able to give the opposition towards the end of the game. And he nearly did it. He should have had the assist. It was world class. It was Lionel Messi-esque. It was just wonderful. The vision, the pinpoint accuracy. And Diaz has unfortunately been one of the best players on the pitch and one of the worst players on the pitch all at the same time, because he should probably at least have had two. Probably would have on another day had a hat-trick. That was the most Luis Suarez performance I've ever seen from a Liverpool player post Luis Suarez without goals.
Yeah, let's talk Luis Diaz, because I was just absolutely in awe with him come the end of the game. And this is the thing about like the perspective of stuff, because
go to Dan next then.
Okay. The perspective of being down the other end of the pitch is, you know, people get chances and they miss chances. It is what it is. The fact that run, it's the run, we mentioned it before.
Which one?
The one
was at least
exactly
the really long Rodri
Walker run, where he's got no right to come away with the ball, let alone twice, let alone the third time, actually get into a crossing position at the end of it all. Just typified how brilliant he was. I thought it was his best performance in probably this season. And yeah, you watch it back, look, missing chances. What I won't have, by the way, is this. I think the one, because again, I think commentary, and this wouldn't have been used because you don't have it on, but I don't think the commentary helps. And I think Gary Neville telling Luis Diaz when he should be shooting and shouldn't be shooting is fucking hilarious. So I'm very wary of not telling footballers when they should and shouldn't shoot. the one-on-one where he goes through from Salah is a big, it's a big opportunity. That's the one, is it? The other one where it's cut back, people are going to take it first time when it's half a yard behind him.
He overran it though. I don't think it was him who caused that. So sorry, but it was. Yeah. He holds his run a little bit further back and he's running onto it. The problem is he overruns the ball and the ball is then therefore behind him. I thought he gave me everything. And you know, when I was reacting to the game afterwards, I was stuck because I want to fume at the fact that he's just not even hit the target with either of the chances. Like, he's had two. It was a spell where it just felt like we were suffocating them. Mm. The ground was at its peak. Edison had just came off, and I don't think we made Ortega make as many saves as we should have. And the ball is simply sublime. It's to go 2-1 up, and who knows, because we're 2-1 up, we've scored two in how many minutes, and we're coming at you again. It had been a totally different game. I thought he was superb. His energy, his effort, his work rate, you can't question any part of it. But ultimately, you can't miss those chances. The first one, I just don't get how he's not hit the target for me.
No, I tend to agree with you. It's definitely, we spoke about this last night in detail on post-match shows and stuff like that, me and Chris, but it's definitely a performance that will polarise opinion. I think that's fair to say, because he was outstanding for the most part. He was a thorn in the side of Man City defenders. He terrorised Man City defenders, as you mentioned there. His work rate, his effort was unwavering from minute 0 to minute 90 plus. He was exceptional. However, when it comes to sort of the crunch moments and the key moments that decide football matches, he left a lot to be desired for me. And you mentioned two there. I'd group the first one in with that as well. He makes himself space, things in the first half, and he fires wide. Middle. And yeah, and it's like, what's frustrating about that one for me, it's not the simple as the other ones. The other ones are probably easier. However, that was his trademark finish. We've seen him do that against Crystal Palace as well, a very similar type of goal, and he just has to hit the target. And you mentioned Ortega there. We were both at him and Chris saying, we just need to test this keeper. I think Joel Quanta had a shot early doors and he made a right mess of it. And you think, okay, if that's a Joel Quanta pretty tame effort, let's see what happens when somebody actually lets fly with one. And it never quite materialised. It was frustrating. But Diaz, I'll come back to it, absolutely brilliant. 9 out of 10 performance in pretty much every single department, apart from the most crucial one.
It's those things that the nature of him and how he plays the game is, I think, it gets underestimated. By the time he gets to those clinical moments, he's fucking done, because he's ran like 40, 50 yards, often with the ball or whatever at his feet in those kind of situations. And we had this with Suarez in his first season, where he'd do all the work and then didn't have the finish to kind of capitalise on that or whatever. I agree, it's frustrating. It's one of them. But I just had that such an overwhelming sense of pride of watching him play and how he played and how he carried the team forward for 90, and the fact that he's not just done it this week, he's been doing it for weeks now. You know, ever since Jota's been injured, he's been the one there. I've had him and Elliot have actually gone to the well. The amount of football they've played in this last 3 weeks or whatever is like ridiculous. You know, there's no way they would be allowed to do that if we had more players available. And that's the thing with Luis Diaz. I know people seem to be critical of whatever. That's why you own Jota, because Jota would come into that game and probably slot down and come away with a couple of goals, but Jota also wouldn't dribble the ball past the two of their best defensive players down the wing and blah blah blah. So I'm prepared.
He's just not a killer. No. Unfortunately, that's just who he is, isn't it? You know, I don't think he's ever going to become that. But you know, in those big moments in these big games, it feels like you need them. It's unfortunate that those chances fell to him every single time. Listen, the one-on-one, you know, from Salah, I still don't know why he didn't go around the goalkeeper for me. Wow, lad, it's so fucking easy, because I think if you go left around the keeper, Walker can't go left with you. No. And it just feels like an absolute tap.
Keeper committed as well.
But even then, just hit the damn target.
I don't need him to score. Oh, yeah. I do, but I don't necessarily do, but make the keeper save it at the very least.
This is the thing. We do this all over where we go, hit the target, you hit the target, but you P-roll at the goal.
Well,
you
know, Nunes hit the target and Ortega makes a good save because of it. I want more out of that. I want more. The first one I think is really interesting. If you watch the first one back when it's on the edge, the ball...
The one from Nunes?
No, the first Diaz chance was, it doesn't clear his feet. Yeah. Like, it's a bad touch, a bit, right. And it gets stuck under him, and it's behind him when he's hitting it. And the third one, probably where you think he overruns it, it's really far behind him. And I was really critical at the time, like, you've got to hit that first time. And when I watched it back, I was like, if he hits that first time, it's probably hitting his left knee.
If you hit that first time,
so far behind him,
you are chipping that up 6 inches off the floor with zero pace directly into the goalkeeper's hands. But again,
it's still not a good touch. He still had options.
It's good defending as well.
It's good defending, don't get me wrong. Of
was
course.
It him and Gakpo who got in each other's way as well a bit later on, when one of them had to shoot and then they laid off to Sally. Just moments like that felt like, as you alluded to a moment ago, falling at the wrong people's feet. Mo Salah over Diogo Jota, different story.
Listen, I agree with the killer thing. It might just be one of those things where he's finally found his fitness, and now you've got that, he needs to find that extra thing comes on top. And it's a big game, it's an opportunity for him, and again, he's running through brick walls for us at the moment. You're right, it might never come.
I said this last night, he's a Darwin Nunes from being offside for putting us up.
Well, that's the other thing.
And luckily, he might not be a 25 to 30 goal a season forward, he might just not be, but if he's not, I mean, how many killers are you allowed to own? Because we own 3 by my reckoning. And maybe there's an opportunity for one or two others to step up in terms of some of those midfield players as well. So Jota's out, Salah's not fit, Darwin Nunes goes off the pitch, you're left with Luis Diaz and Cody Gakpo. I mean, woe is us. I thought his all round contribution to the game was just absolutely
phenomenal. He was brilliant.
I kind of glossed over it, but Harvey Elliott's the same. That's another huge game of football. He's played. We were wondering when he was going to get his start, Chris. And ultimately, he's gotten his start because all the lads have been injured. And every single time he faces a test, he seems to just come out on top. And I reiterate from the top of the show, he's 20 years old. He's 20. People are absolutely wanking themselves to death over Phil Foden. And by the way, fair play, because he's sensational. But he's like, what, 3 or 4 years older now than Harvey Elliott? And Elliott is, just barely talked about. Very much the 12th or 13th man in our squad consistently this year. But I think he's absolutely magic.
I think I saw somebody else say this, but he's a fan first and footballer second. It might have been Errol last night, you know what I mean? And that's what comes across, isn't it? But it's also the versatility. It's the ability to go up against Nathan Ake, who physically will dominate Harvey Elliott in terms of his physique, in terms of his speed and his size and his strength. And there's nothing there that would make you think Harvey Elliott can beat him. But he puts up a good showing. And then he comes inside and plays in midfield, and I think he gets better again. I think Liverpool get another measure of control where you probably thought, well, actually, when Szoboszlai was in there, yeah, he grew into the game, but Elliot took that mantle and got us better again, made us better again. So he's just, he defies what I think he should be time and time again. And it's got to the point where I'm blind because I should be able to see what he gives every single time he takes the field, but he just keeps on getting stronger. Keeps on getting stronger as games go on. And I said this the other week, it's not that he's a good sub, it's just the 70 minutes into the game, whether he starts or he comes on, he's amazing. Like, he just gets better and better all the time. And It's amazing to see, really, because I do think physically he is going to be held back from where he can be in his career. But then there are players who proved you wrong, who it didn't matter. You know, Cesc Fabregas comes to mind. You know, wasn't the fastest, wasn't the strongest. Xabi Alonso wasn't the fastest, wasn't strong. Achieved absolutely everything in the game. And Harvey Elliott, I think, probably does end up a little bit more like them than maybe a winger like Mo because of that. And you know, I think Odegaard should probably be the stick for where he wants to be in 2 to 3 years' time. And I think if he gets the opportunities, and he will get the opportunities because he performs each and every week, that's where we'll be thinking of him.
I just think he's great. And this is just another game when he's gone and emptied the tank. And then, he gets asked to come back 3 days later and go and empty the tank again. And then another 3 days later and go and empty the tank again. It was another one where the full-time whistle goes and he collapses to the deck because he's just run himself into the ground. And, you know, players who want to go for the cut, the amount of times he just charged the goalie down to make sure that they were kept on their toes, and yet we're still able to have little moments of class and magic and nice touches and stuff. Yeah, really, really impressed. Right, let's do the
big... It's finished, by the way, for the one who put it in the line. Yeah, hell of a finish.
Yeah.
Glad he scored as well. Yeah, because we didn't know. We was offside, but we weren't sure at the time.
Like, somebody put it in the back of the net. The flag up there, we said that.
But I'm glad he put it in the back of the net. But just to sort of round off on Harvey Elliott, his energy knows no bounds, does it? It's remarkable what he's doing at the moment, and more power to
him. And this is the thing of, again, him and Diaz, they have... And McAllister's added in there, and you know, Endo since he's come back as well. You know, lads who've just taken the Virgil van Dijk. There's loads. There's fucking loads. But actually, in the attacking positions, the ones who've played the most minutes in this time is Elliot and Diaz. And every game they're asked to just go and go and go and go, and they have all the hallmarks of a classic Jurgen Klopp player, because that was what we used to have. Play like 15 players all season, and basically that's what you'd be required of. It makes my heart, it's not too poetic, but it makes my heart swell when I see people like that take to the pitch, so I can forgive little moments where you lack a little quality right at the finishing end of it, because it shouldn't get underestimated how hard it is to do that and then somehow have enough breath in your body to be able to slow the game down and take those clinical moments on top. It's what actually makes Darwin Núñez so special, because he seems to be able to do everything when the game's going his way. Should we bother doing the penalty? Let's do the penalty. Yeah, we mentioned the composure, McAllister, great. It was just wonderful timing for the whole thing. I'm not one who likes to talk about players getting injured as such, but the Edison one's going to be interesting, Chris, because he is a huge player for them. If he misses any football off the back of that, then that's going to be something that obviously causes them problems. But Darwin, people mentioned him being offside. I had no idea that he was offside so many times, ultimately, because it's the game being played in front of you. But his energy, his desire to get him behind. I did Saturday Social at the weekend, and I picked Núñez over Haaland, partly because I'm a Liverpool fan and wholly biased, but just to actually have the conversation that was the difference between the two players. Darwin Núñez will run all day, he'll try and make things happen for a football team. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And then you've got Erling Haaland, that if he doesn't get service, he does fuck all in a football match. I would, as a poet on the inside, I think I'd probably prefer Darwin Núñez, but then that's maybe just me.
I'll leave that one. but from the performances yesterday, there was a clear winner, wasn't there? And it was Darwin Núñez for me, because of how involved he is in everything. You're not just there to put the ball in the back of the net. You are actually making the team better, whereas I don't think Haaland actually makes their team better than putting the ball in the back of the net. It's like Guardiola somehow managed to get this 10-man team to be able to press incredibly well, which is in and of itself is an achievement, by the way. But then he had Messi, and he had to do the same for Lionel Messi, and he had to do the same over the years with Sergio Aguero at Manchester City, who wasn't really the player. So he knows how to get a tune out of a team which has a striker, and fair play, it's his striker, he bought him. It's sound, isn't it? But like, Darwin Núñez feels more us than Erling Haaland, certainly, because of just being that little bit more emotional and, you know, a bit more crazy and all that type of stuff. But he's going to give you absolutely everything each and every single week. And some weeks he's going to take you to the moon, and other weeks you just want to bury your head in the sand. That's the type of footballer he is, but he is getting to the point where he's putting in world-class performances week in, week out.
Yeah, no, he was brilliant. Okay, the actual controversial incident then. Doku, McAllister. I came out of the ground and I had no idea this was a thing. I didn't get to see it. I started watching some of the game back, but I had other bits and pieces to do, so I didn't really see it until this morning. So it was really funny that I just came out just buzzing with the overall performance and disappointed we didn't get the winning goal. And then I saw social media was just awash with people just being really angry and all this kind of stuff. Chloe, what was your... Did you have any view of this in the ground?
On the cop, I instantly said, it's a penalty. He's kicked him in the chest, but I'm on the cop. And that was the Annie Road end. So once it gets waved away for just a corner, I'm like, maybe it's not there. Maybe he's just jumped in, but he actually hasn't put his foot out. But it certainly looked like it from on the cop. And it turns out I was right. It was a kick to the chest that should have been a penalty. And I could see it from, you know, however many yards away. Yeah, to, you know, Michael Oliver. Fair enough, McAllister's back's in front of him, so maybe he can't see. But how VAR have not said to him, aye, mate, do you want to go and take another look at that? Is astounding. And the only way, like, I come up the ground and I'm walking back to my car and everyone's just going, we've been robbed here. That's a penalty. And I didn't understand what they were going on about. Sat there, got it up on my phone and was like, how on earth is that not being given? The only way I can describe it is, if the roles are reversed and still a defensive situation for Doku, but McAllister kicks him in the chest first, Michael Oliver, it's the easiest foul he's ever going to be given. Yeah. And he's going to give it because he's not impacting the game. It's okay. Well, it's clearly a foul here, but all it's done really is a free kick to Manchester City. It's not a dangerous moment to really have an impact on the game. They've just shit the bed, and that is all I can say to you is that it's too big of a game, it's too big of a situation. If that's 60 minutes in, I think it gets given, but it's not, and it's virtually the last kick of the game, and because it's a penalty that's potentially on the line, they just don't give it. They don't want to impact the game that much, and that's on the officials.
I thought Klopp was quite vociferous on it, Dan. Mm-hmm. You know, he basically saying what Chloe said. You could put that in any of the four corners of the pitch at any other time during the match, and you're getting a free kick for that, and you might even be looking at a yellow card for Doku for it. But I've heard plenty. I think he then said everyone who's any football people would probably see that. There was a reasonable split, I thought, in the Sky Sports studio. There was a split in the Match of the Day studio on it as well. The split seemed to lean towards people who haven't got a great skin in the game towards the Liverpool Football Club, but that might be a separate thing.
Or people who do and then are overcompensating by just going the complete and opposite way, Jamie Carragher.
Did he?
Yeah. Not a pen.
Well, Jamie Carragher's a defender.
I saw him on Twitter. Replying to someone, I think it was Joel or something like that.
I think Cara said something. It wasn't.
You need more for a penalty.
I thought it was quite interesting that he said you need more for a penalty.
He's right though, isn't he? That they do need more for a penalty.
Yes, Liverpool.
Like the referees, they shouldn't. But he is right. In fact, I did see a bit of this. It was the unwritten rule stuff, wasn't it? But he said it was an unwritten rule that you need a bit more for a penalty.
Which is mad.
That is fucking true. He's right there.
He is. And then you see Garnacho's penalty, at Old Trafford against Everton.
Which is far less.
The first one.
Everyone looks at it and goes, he's kicked him in the leg. It's a penalty. But at the same time, there's nothing more about that tackle. You know what I mean? That's just his foot. It's his foot, and Garnacho throws himself to the floor. It's not De Jong.
No.
You know, it's not Nigel De Jong, you know, full-blown karate kick, you know, to the
It's not Tyrone Mings from last season where Gakpo walked around like Wolverine.
There was a bit of me hoping McAllister would just show. If he did have any marks, I was kind of thinking, just lift your top up, mate, and then that might solve this problem.
Too busy writhing around in agony on the floor, Dan.
I was also shouting, stay down at the time, as I was really milking it as much as possible.
The problem is, though, everyone who watches it back says he wins the ball first. He doesn't win the ball first.
It comes off McAllister onto Doku.
That's true.
If you're clumsy enough to make a challenge like that in the box in the final minute of a game, you deserve to get a penalty given against you. It's ludicrous. Chrissy from Jeremy Doku, why are you putting your foot that high up in that situation? And it's just really annoying because if it's McAllister and it's on Doku, the exact same situation, it's giving a free kick to Man City because there's just no jeopardy around it. But because it is, I just think the moment, the occasion is ultimately what's not gave.
I'm not into this whole, because again, we said every week, everyone goes, corruption. I just don't, I'm not, it's probably not corruption, but it is, I think there's a big decision to be made there. And look, I think Michael Oliver's a really good referee. You know, I think he's been the best Premier League referee for a good long spell now. I've seen references in the comments. He's obviously gone and ref some games in the Arab Emirates and what have you, as have they all. I was very trusting of him being in there. I think referees can get it wrong, but it goes back to Klopp's point of like, VAR's there, they have a look at that. But it is one, I would say, just to don't play full devil's advocate on this, is that it's actually one of the rare ones that looks less bad in slow motion, because you take the pace out of it by slowing it down. I think in normal time, it looks far more impactful and it looks more painful. But when the more you watch of it, I don't think it's, because again, I say it's not a De Jong, it's not a kick to the chest. I've seen people reference Sadio Mane's one at the Etihad, which I thought at the time was incredibly soft because he's looking at the ball the whole way, but he also kicks Edison in the face while he's doing it. There's always going to be, there'll be a million examples of those that have been given them in the other way. I do think it was a pen. I'm not totally sold on it was an absolute nailed on pen.
For me, it has to be. I still can't quite fathom how it isn't, to be perfectly honest, because moreover, I agree with the Michael Oliver point, by the way. I'm not sort of, the pressure isn't on him for me to give that. The VR just say, you need to go have another look at this, mate, and then decide for yourself.
Bare minimum.
That was the threshold we kind of came to last night. Yeah, but for me, there's a reason McAllister, and I agree with what Chloe said about roles reverse. I actually tweeted that from our account this morning, but like, there's a reason McAllister doesn't go with his foot, because he knows if he does, there's a good chance he gives away a free kick, because if Doku goes with his head, then there's a problem. Doku doesn't make that decision. Doku decides to go with his foot, and therefore endangers the opponent and all that sort of stuff. And for me, regardless of who touches the ball first, which is an element, it's a factor in all of this, don't get me wrong, but the minute your studs make contact with somebody's ribcage, if that's in the penalty area, I'm sorry, but that's a penalty. You can't do that. The studs in the ribcage, even saying those words in a row sounds silly to suggest it isn't a foul. That can't happen. It's mental.
Also, I'm pretty sure the FA thing is, no matter who gets the ball first, if you're endangering an opponent, it's a foul. And I'm so sorry, but where his foot lands on McAllister is endangering an opponent. So
there's just no consistency, because you see things that look like stonewall pens and then you can complain that the people in the VAR don't understand the biology, the gravity, the physics, you know, of those things. And the one that always stands out is Jota at Tottenham. Was it last year or the year before?
The push from
You know, when he basically slows down and gets absolutely bundled to the ground, it's like, well, what are you doing? It's a penalty all day long. And then there's that one of like, that had all the hallmarks. I think why it's most annoying is because it's got all the hallmarks of the thing that VAR gives. VAR gives that shit week in, week out, because as you're saying, it's Doku, his foot is at chest height and it makes contact with it. And again, when I say I don't think it's stonewall, I'd look, because I've had this time and time again, they call it a high bar, I'd call it a low bar in some regards of how we've lowered the threshold.
I've seen penalties given for someone literally getting whacked on the head and putting their hands on their head,
in the pen this season. Danny Welbeck get a penalty for Andy Roberts making contact with his toe at Brighton. Absolutely pathetic. And if those are penalties, then why isn't this even being sent to review? That's the annoying thing about the whole thing.
The magnitude of
this, and the VAR world. The referee makes it. If the referee's just making his decision, I'll be annoyed, but I'll go, referee's made a call.
I can't have it. I've sat here silently, right? I listen to everybody, and you're all right in various things, and you're all spot on. But let me explain it to you. Our man runs into the penalty area, chests the ball, and then gets kicked in the chest. And you're telling me that's not a penalty? Our man runs into the penalty area, chests the ball, and then gets kicked in the chest.
Yeah,
and it's not a penalty. And why is it not a penalty? Because it's 98 minutes into a game of football between the top two, and it could decide the title. So for whatever reason, Michael Oliver is or isn't the best referee in the country, and he is the best referee in the country, he has absolutely shit the bed. And on top of all of that, lads on Twitter can fucking zoom in and see that we've seen the ball on a fucking phone that's recording Sky Sports footage. VAR have better than that. VAR should be able to take a minute, because we've already added 9 minutes onto this game or whatever, eight minutes onto this game. Take a minute. You've already had 30 seconds probably before the ball goes out. Look at it and tell Michael Oliver, we don't think he's got the ball. That's where you're wrong, because that's what, when Dermot Gallagher's talking about it on Sky Sports, he's obviously heard what the conversation is. And when you watch the Dermot Gallagher thing, he says, well, they've had a conversation about it, and Oliver says, I think he's got the ball first. So your point there is, okay, has he got the ball first? And if he doesn't, which he doesn't, then you have to tell Michael Oliver, say, actually, you're wrong, he doesn't get the ball first. There's a penalty there for Liverpool Football Club. Liverpool go and score the penalty and win the league, sound no problem. But the fact is, this will make us kick on anyway.
Yeah.
Because now there's a defiance, and Liverpool with defiance, and Liverpool with something going against them is the scariest type of Liverpool Football Club. So thank you very much, Michael Oliver. Thank you very much, VAR. But you have just spared us on.
Yeah. I am. Sorry, Chloe. Yeah. Yeah, look. Yeah. Do you agree or disagree with Chris? Let us know. No, I again, I suppose it goes back to the humanity of it. If Michael Oliver makes a decision, he's made a decision one way or the other. And I can agree, he might well have absolutely just decided, I am not making myself the centre of this story one way or the other. But that's what the point, and it goes back to the cross, but that's what VAR is there for. Yeah. And again, it goes back to, but I had no idea. I that's the first time I've heard anyone talk about it coming off McAllister's shoulder before that.
Oh, mate, every bit of coverage last night on Twitter.
Yeah. Every bit of coverage was Doc. It's Doc who's won the ball first. Shea Given was saying it on Match of the Day, and I can see it hitting Doc who's foot, and then his foot follows through. I mean, again, we've seen Curtis Jones get sent off for a similar sort of kind of thing. It's annoying. Because, yeah, that would have made a huge difference in the title.
It should actually make a difference whether he gets the ball, because it's still a foul.
Yeah, exactly.
That should be irrelevant.
He's still endangering an opponent. And also, can I just say, we beat Nottingham Forest and it's up in absolute flames, right? Yeah, that because someone's had a drop ball somewhere 2 minutes prior to a goal, right? Yeah, and yeah, there's absolute crickets around right now for a clear. But this is the thing, I actually think if what happens at Nottingham Forest doesn't happen, maybe you get the goal, maybe you get the penalty, maybe you get it, but they can't possibly beat. Oh no. Come on, well,
I don't think they've got time to think about that necessarily. I think
Oliver was thinking about that.
No,
I think they've got to make it. Can't possibly do it now.
I agree with the premise that thought process wise, the magnitude of the situation and the implications, not just for that game, but title race, I'm okay with that. Certainly, in the VR room.
That's fine.
But other than that, I'm a little bit, maybe not.
But why not? Because it's happened a week before and there's been so much uproar.
There's the speed at which it happens.
No, but you're going to not want to make massive decisions later on. Okay. That's my point. My point isn't Liverpool got it, a plus last time. It's more of, I don't really want to make massive decisions that can implicate
people
things.
People talk so much about Liverpool and the late goals and refereeing decisions that untruths become truth by proxy. So like there's this like notion somehow, this whole like Liverpool thing, and the Liverpool, you get loads of penalties.
We're going to get through the episode.
No. But you get loads, and Liverpool get loads of penalties at Anfield. We don't. We get statistically less penalties at home than top teams get at their normal home ground by like some measure over the last, certainly the Jurgen Klopp era. Liverpool don't get anywhere near the penalties that a side that has the levels of possession, the amount of touches in the opposition area that they should do by basically the simple equation that you plug in there. But it filters into referees' opinions, and I honestly wouldn't shock me if it was just a very slightly unconscious bias from someone like Michael Oliver. He's gone, Liverpool, there was a massive refereeing decision that got all kinds of scrutiny last week. Tierney's getting booted off things as a result of it. I'm just gonna stay out of this one, and it'll be a tight game between two top teams. No harm, no foul.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be in the minute. It's in the lead up. It's before kickoff.
Yeah, I get that.
I'm not talking about in the minute. He sat there thinking to himself, actually,
takes me back
to the 99th minute. No, I'm saying the entire week he's thinking to himself, knowing that he's going to referee that game.
And even if he's not actually sat there having a deep old think about it, it's just referees talk about these. You watch your mates getting in all kinds of shit, and they've
all got fucking ref watch series linked.
But they don't want to be centre of attention. That's their biggest thing, ref. They don't want to be the headline story, I guess, is the point on that. But also, get your decisions right. Do your job
just
properly, and they haven't done that.
9 out of 10 referees give that.
Yeah, of course you do, yeah.
Yeah. Smart. And the fact that, is it Mike Dean sat there thinking, I think that's going to go to the monitor, that one. Yeah, looks like it's a pen, yeah. Oh, actually, yeah, no, he's correct. It's not a pen, they've waited away, yeah, because he gets the ball.
Absolute sixpence he turned.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've got better things to talk about. Alexis.
Majestic.
Yeah,
Alex McAllister,
absolutely just a wonderful, wonderful footballer. And yet again, another one I got outvoted on the weekend trying to get him into me combined to the Liverpool Arsenal City 11, because apparently they wanted to play Declan Rice attacking mid, which I then railed against, and then he did it at the weekend. So it made me look a little bit foolish, but he's getting better and better. And it's funny because on Alexis, Chris, I thought about November he's going to be one of those footballers for whom just things have conspired against him, and we're probably never going to see the player that we actually bought because Curtis Jones had been so good, Szoboszlai had been so good, Gravenberch was starting to look okay, Elliot's been absolutely brilliant, you've still got Thiago to come back into the team at some point, we've seen Gakpo, you know, used in the attacking role as well at times, and then McAllister's doing the DM stuff. We're not going to buy it, looks like we're not buying a DM, and he's been fine. That might just be his lot for Liverpool. And that would be a bit unfortunate, but you know, he's doing a really good job at six, isn't he? And now we're playing him in his position, and he just looks absolutely sensational.
He's better for playing in the six as well. I think he's got this understanding with Endo of where Endo needs him to be able to get in the ball. And I think that I've been saying this for a couple of weeks now, but it's made more true. I think for looking at where Szoboszlai was on the field and where McAllister was and who was free and involved in the game. Out of the two of them. So obviously he hasn't played the six, wasn't in those areas where the six can get the ball to very easily. Whereas McAllister was there all the time, an option for Endo, an option for the centre-halves, while still playing advanced, while still playing balls into the box. You know, again, I'll reference that ball into Darwin Núñez, that's from the 10 position. And yet when we need him, he's back, he's defending, he's everything. He sort of reminds me in some ways of, to go on maybe a Paul Machin sort of thing, is like a Ferrari, you know what I mean? What makes a Ferrari great? Well, it looks fucking good, but it's the engine that fucking sets it apart, you know what I mean? And he's got the engine to get back and forwards and go all over the place, and yet while he's doing it, he still looks fucking sexy as fuck. And when you put the ball at his feet, he just plays it, and just this, just like he's got so much time and so much space, and he's never rushed, and he seems to pick the right ball out, and he's honestly getting better and better. And I went back this morning because I'm doing a deep dive on him tomorrow, and I looked at, like, me and Dan were talking yesterday about signings of the season and stuff, and I looked at like what the predictions were for sign of the season, and I looked through quite a few, and one of them I found from quite a reputable source had a top 20 signings of the season. McAllister wasn't even on the fucking list, like, for top 20 signings of the season. And if Liverpool win the league, he's going to be the signing of the season.
Him or Wataru Endo?
Close one thing. Both exceptional. Just to spin off, we spoke of a big old bit on McAllister last night. I described him as the master of ceremonies from a Liverpool perspective, because I just think he's wonderful. And everything that's good about Liverpool at the moment is going through him time and time again. I take your point with Wataru Endo, exceptional. Said it earlier on, bargain the season. His work rate, his ethic, his energy is just remarkable. But Alexis McAllister right now is the life and soul of Liverpool Football Club when we're playing. He's unbelievable, and he offers apps. There's not a thing that man cannot do, because he's got all the sick stuff going on, the defensive responsibilities, win the ball back, he's harrying people, he's pressing. And then when he gets it, it's like he reverses into a different type of player altogether. He becomes a 10, he's got that number on his back, and all of a sudden he goes, oh yeah, I've got the ball now, I can watch me orchestrate things. It's just incredible, honestly. And I was with you in a sense of, I wasn't sure what we were going to see from him, wasn't sure whether he was ever going to materialise into the player that we expected, the player we hoped, the player we wanted, the player he is, because it felt like things were conspiring against him a little bit. But right now, he's got this side. And listen, Virgil van Dijk's been brilliant, Wataru Endo's been brilliant, and so on and so on, Kevin Kelleher. But Alexis McAllister, it's his world right now. He's remarkable.
Yeah,
it's great. Like, if you want to get to the Wirral, you know what I mean? There's a couple of different ways, but if you want to get there quickly, you go through the fucking tunnel. You can go round the houses, you can still get to the Wirral by going over the Runcorn Bridge. But if you want to get there fast, you want to get us from there to there, go through Alexis McAllister, mate. Yeah. That's how we're getting there quickly.
Excellent. Just lastly on this one, go ahead. How are we feeling, Ben, about the whole title race?
We're going to win it.
We all think we're banging it.
We're winning it.
I'd go on further.
Yeah. Chloe, you asked the question because right now City, although they're top of the league, are third favourites to win the league.
Arsenal.
Arsenal are like 16% to win it, and you were up in arms how that's a thing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Arsenal fans are probably having very much of these conversations this Monday. Go on, you don't.
If I was them, I'd love that. I'd love being an underdog. Mm. So I'd actually see that as great. Look, I would never at the start of the season have expected us to be here. And to be perfectly honest, I'm just enjoying the ride. I don't feel fear. Going into Manchester City's game, I thought I would be horrific. We all know how bad I am. I wasn't an ounce scared during any part of that game. I wasn't worried. I wasn't nervous. I wasn't feeling ill. And that's very unlike me. And I think it's just because I'm just enjoying it. Like, I didn't expect to be here. I know we've only got a small time left of Jurgen Klopp, and I'm going to go there, get behind the Reds and enjoy us as much as we can. And, you know, a couple of seasons ago when we were in a title race with Manchester City, coming out of that game, I'd have probably have felt absolutely devastated the fact that we haven't won. But I didn't feel that either. I thought there was so much positivity to take from that game, and it's very unlike me in a title race to be that calm. So for right now, I'm
not just...
Not just
in a title race.
No, just any... just watching football, but yeah, no, I'm just enjoying it. That's all I will say. There's three unbelievable teams there, all who have a chance. But, you know, ask me again after the City-Arsenal game, please.
I think the general sense of this is the pressure's on Man City because they're Man City and they've got 115 financial charges hanging over the head of the treble winners, which I've been reminded of so many times over the last few days.
Well, they have to remind you because it wasn't really in the news.
Someone's got to talk about it, the handful of Man City fans. Arsenal are under immense pressure because now all of a sudden they're back in the box seat, which is good, and haven't fallen foul last season. There's an expectation of them going one step beyond. They're now in, you know, until the weekend, free score and goal scoring
also,
form.
Sorry,
Chloe, let me just but my general sense about the Liverpool thing is just exactly what you've said there. I'm just enjoying it. I'm really enjoying watching Liverpool, and I know some people feel pressure in different ways and what have you, but I think it's definitely possible. I saw all the evidence to say it's possible. This is what it is. It's 10 games left, and I have to practice what I preach, and all I've said and all I ever say every fucking year we do these podcasts is don't look at the league until 10 games gone, and the title race doesn't start until 10 games to go. Well, if the title race begins now, we are joint top with Arsenal. If you think we're not in a title race and we're not ready for it, then you've not been paying attention.
The thing I was about to say to jump in then on Arsenal was, there's pressure on Manchester City because Manchester City face Arsenal at the Etihad. Yeah. They don't lose at the Etihad, especially not with a Rodri in their team. But Arsenal have just seen what a weakened Liverpool side can do against that Manchester City side. So there is a little bit of pressure on Arsenal going into that game as well. I know it was at Anfield, but that's a City side that Liverpool, with a couple of kids in there, took the mick out of in that second half. So there's a lot of pressure on Arsenal there as well. So yeah, it's just enjoying.
It's fun that all three of the sides have got five home games and five away games, and they've all got some big games still to come, haven't they? I think, you know, there's a few derbies in there for us. I think Arsenal have probably got the fewest in terms of what you would say are like the real tough games, but they might have the toughest still to come in Manchester City. Because I'm dead sad, I actually worked out the average position in the league table of where everybody, the teams that we face, we've actually got the easiest in terms of average position. Ours is 10.1, Manchester City's is 9.5, and Arsenal's is 9.3, if I remember correctly.
Our biggest issue with this is that we've got to go to Old Trafford and we've got to go to Goodison Park, are the two big ones there. And what we were talking about, Chloe, is that Arsenal have got, they've got Tottenham, I think they've got
Spurs
a North London
away,
derby in there as well, haven't they? So like
they've got Chelsea in there, and I think City,
and again Chelsea
Villa,
trying to spoil Arsenal's day will be massive. Everyone's got to play Villa, I think everyone's got to play Brighton as well, which is could be anything of those games. But
Brighton's points per game at home is so much better than away as
so
well. Arsenal are away at Brighton, and I think Arsenal are averaging 2.08 points per game away from home, and I think Brighton are on about 1.78. So they do pretty well at home, do Brighton?
Yeah. And that's
that's sad, isn't it?
Well, no,
they've
both got
Spurs away. And we've got them at home.
City
drew 3-3 or something at home.
Yeah, okay, well then, well, like, this is, there's plenty of twists and turns. The annoying thing for us is that they're hugely emotive games with so much more pressure on us as fans, because I just don't want to live in a world where Evertonians have got this, we stopped just winning the league, or Manx have got, because they've taken draws off us actually in that game in previous seasons when we've lost it by a point or whatever, and I've had it a little bit. It's going to be so close to the end now that I can write it off when it happens in February.
Yeah.
But when it starts to come in, end of March, April, into May, that's when it's...
The beauty of us now, though, is that to sort of reference what you were saying a moment ago in terms of obviously Klopp's farewell tour, and we're just kind of glad to be here in a way. It's a lot more than that. That's played it down to the nth degree. Of course it is. But there's no second chance now under Jurgen Klopp to do this. Yeah. This is it. You know what I mean? There's no room for complacency. There's no room for, oh, well, it just didn't quite happen. We'll wait till
it's
next year.
Almost like it's the last dance.
Exactly. But in his last 10 games now, we're going to Goodison, we're going to Old Trafford, where historically we have dropped points under Jurgen Klopp. There's no room for that because we can't get him next year under Klopp because there isn't a next year under Klopp. So I think all that conspiring in our favour, plus the fact, you know, the top line amongst all of this is, we're doing what we're doing right now with this threadbare squad, absolutely depleted. Over the next 2, 3, 4 weeks, we're going to start adding back your Alisson Becker, your Trent Alexander Arnold, your Curtis Jones, your Ryan Gravenberch, Ibu Kanate is on the cusp of returning. So I'm
Diogo Jota, please.
Jota at some point. I'm full of optimism heading
into
this.
I mean, just one little mention for the goal difference thing. Like, the thing is, Arsenal have got the better goal difference. Arsenal didn't have the better goal difference 3 weeks ago. Arsenal scored a load of goals in the last few weeks, and that's why they got the better goal difference.
I think they've scored 28 and conceded 3 in the last 8.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing, is like that if they carry on like that, then that'll be a huge factor. But it only takes, it's mad. If they lose a game of football in there at any point, A, for a start, the goal difference won't matter for shit if you lose a game of football and everyone else wins. But also, you know, then if Liverpool win a game in that spell when they've lost one or drawn one at any given point, then it changes. So I'm firmly on the whole Liverpool are doing top thing, because the goal difference thing is it is a fact that it technically puts them top of the league, and it will be a huge deciding factor if they remain locked on points come the end of the season. But it's not a real factor until the season ends. So
it's happened once, I think, in Premier League history. If you end up the points with them, fair play to them. They do probably deserve it for having a better goal difference. Yeah. But the likelihood is you don't actually end on the same points.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, mammoth. We are going to take a break, and we are going to talk about some of the other things going on this week around the Reds. But yes, stay tuned and join us in a second.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, welcome back. Yes.
Paul, you've got to explain that to us, mate.
Right. So some people will have caught bits of this via Twitter, and anyone who's watched the vlog. So yeah, there's a vlog of my trip, not just the match, but my trip to Prague in the week.
Your trip to Heathrow and your trip to Leeds as well was in there.
Yeah. So I don't even know where to begin. So I had my flights booked through Lufthansa, and I was all set to go. I was doing this BBC thing with Robbie on, I don't even know what day this was, but Wednesday, right? Yeah. Wednesday, yeah. I was in Manchester Wednesday. So I thought, right, I'll book my flight from Manchester because I'm there, and I'll go to Prague. So I was meant to go Manchester to Munich to Prague and then back. And then Monday night, I think it was, I got an email saying there's strikes happening with Lufthansa in Germany. So basically all the Lufthansa flights were cancelled. I was like, right, shit. So I then went, okay, well, let's see what the other alternatives were. So I booked another one from Manchester, reasonable sort of time, kind of thing, fine. British Airways, which then flew from Manchester to Heathrow, Heathrow to Prague. Okay, but makes no odds to me how I get there, just that I get there, it's absolutely fine. And then I walked out of this BBC thing, all buzzing, cloud nine. Oh, really, really good. To an email from British Airways saying my flight from Heathrow to from Manchester to Heathrow was cancelled because of weather conditions in London. So at this point, it's like 12:30 in the afternoon. The flight is scheduled for 7:50. If I go to the airport, like Manchester Airport, what are they going to tell me? It's cancelled. There were no other flights out of Manchester that got me to Prague that night. But it was still telling me that my Heathrow to Prague flight was fine. So I was like, well, I'll just jump on a train down to London. That makes sense, right? I can catch that second leg. I've beaten the system here. I can go and get down there. When everyone's locked in Manchester Airport, not able to go anywhere, I can just go down and make that flight. So I legged it from basically from Old Trafford to Piccadilly, jumped on a train, like which arrived like 2 minutes after I got there, got down there. You then have to get to Heathrow miles. So you've then got to go on two tubes to get across there to get to Heathrow. I got there, and as I got there, I found out, I got a message saying it's been delayed. That flight's been delayed. And when you walk into Heathrow, you realise that these weather disruptions have basically cleared the slate all day long. So there's bodies
out
everywhere.
Of interest, what was the weather when you got to Heathrow?
It was England, Chris. It was fine. You know what I mean?
I was just wondering, like...
It was fine. It was weather. You know what I mean? It was just like, I'm in England. What do you want? Apparently it was windy or something. I don't know.
Did you check Big Jet TV?
If only. That was where, if only I'd had a bit more information. But then you've got that thing about what you do. Because again, you know, we've been on flights before. And you know, and you get a sense for this stuff. When something's delayed, you can't help but wonder what happens next. Why is it delayed? Is it then going to be, are they delaying it because it's bad and it's going to stay bad and they just refuse to cancel it? Or is it just, you know, it's been a little bit of a while turning it around and getting it back out. So anyway, I looked at my options and there was nothing reasonable. There was nothing else coming out of Heathrow anytime soon. So it was either, bite the bullet, there was one from Leeds the next morning and I messaged my wife and scoffed of like, well, 8:00 at Leeds the next morning, I could do that. But like, if I do that, that's another set of problems. I'm in for a penny, in for a pound. This is what most people have to do. You have to put your faith in the carriers. You have to put your faith in the airports. So I'm at Heathrow. I've come this way. I'll just do it. And then after like an extra 2 hour wait, it finally went. I went to the gate, all great, queued, scanned me boarding pass. And the guy went, oh, sorry, we've had a bit of an issue with our system all day. It's been a bad day. I'll just take you over to my manager. So he takes me passport and boarding pass on my phone. So he walks me round to this manager who has got this American family there with two teenage daughters, one of whom is bawling her eyes out, crying her eyes out in the middle of the airport. And he's arguing with this, and I'm like, well, this doesn't bode well, does it? Like, this guy's not gonna go, well, fuck you, family in tears. I'm just going to sort this guy's problem and his problem's going to be absolutely fine. And effectively, yeah, he could do nothing. This family had been bumped. Their flight had been cancelled in the morning. So they'd been pushed back and then got told they could get on this plane eventually. There was another woman who'd been told the same thing. But I was like, I've literally got a boarding pass for this plane. This is my flight. I didn't book this morning. And because I'd understand if you're trying to get me on another flight.
You did book this morning.
No, I booked the day before. Like, but you know, the point is, this is not you putting me on it, trying to squeeze me onto a plane. I paid to be on this plane. And he's going, yeah, but you know, it's not my decision. It's nothing to do with me. You know, that whole like, you know, you see those airport programs where people are knobheads to people in airports who work at airports and you go, come on, they're only humans. But try it. Like, honestly, when this guy's going, it's nothing to do with me. And I'm like, mate, you are literally employed by British Airways and there's no one else here I can talk to. So I'm going to have to talk to you about this being a problem. And how is it possibly my fault or my problem? Why have you decided that I can't get on this plane? So he then calls over another manager. And this is the guy who's in the video, who basically reveals to us that originally they'd said, we changed aircraft at the last minute, so that meant the seats were reconfigured, so some people weren't therefore on the plane. And I'm like, I'm in 10F, mate. 10F is 10F. If you're telling me there's no 10th row on this aeroplane, then you've got wider issues than where I should be sitting. And anyway, the manager then comes over and yeah, he has the revelation, which is the thing that's done my head in more than anything. It's based on the price of your fare. So the lower fare, if you paid a lower fare for your ticket, then you're the first people to get to get taken off. They bump you off for people who've paid more money to be on at some other point.
It sounds like England in 2024.
It's fucking batshit crazy. And I was raging about it. And it was funny, I told this to the makeup person, Sky, and this woman, she went, "Oh, that is outrageous." And I was like, that was the reaction I was looking for from someone. Yeah, thanks so much. But weirdly, it was that thing where if they'd just been dead nice to me, I'd have probably just gone and got a hotel in London, got a pint, and then come back to Liverpool the next morning, like tail between my legs and whatever. But I was so angry that I was like, I am not wasting this entire day. I'd rather have no sleep and push on and do the lead. So yeah, as you see in the vlog, I then got that there was a 11:30. This is 10 o'clock at night. I had to go back. We've done this in Porto. It is basically, you're not meant to go out of an airport once you're in. You know what I mean? Like, they're not set up for that to be a thing. So there's no signage saying exit, because you exited by getting on a plane. So we had to figure out how to get out of it. So we ended up going, I went back through passport control, bearing in mind no one had checked my passport up to this point because it wasn't getting checked till I was at the gate. So I had to go, I had arrived and come, and it was a Liverpool fan, I think, because he knew who I was on the passport desk. Was like, what's happening? Why aren't you going? And I was like, we then had to go back, and then someone then told me there was nothing they could do about it there, so I couldn't like wait around and get a refund on the spot or whatever. Here's a pamphlet, you can sort it out online. I was like, if I can sort it out online, I'd have sorted it out. Anyway, so at 10 o'clock, I had to go all the way back to Euston, then walk to King's Cross, jumped on a train to Leeds at 11:30 at night, which then got me in 40 minutes earlier, which was the best thing that happened the whole trip. But basically 2 o'clock in the morning, I got into Leeds, got a taxi to the airport, to the hotel, which was a 5-minute taxi the next morning, supposedly, to the airport. But it's called the Britannia Leeds Bradford Airport Hotel. And I went, I'm only here for like 2 hours, and then I'm going to the airport. How do I do that? And she was, ooh, it's not really very easy to get to the airport from here in a taxi. It's the fucking Leeds.
Do you not have roads around here?
It's the Leeds Bradford Airport Hotel. It's in your name. Why can I not get a taxi from here? Fortunately, I got an Uber booked in the morning, and yeah, I had an hour 45 kip, got a shower, got dressed, and went to the airport.
Slept through the match.
And I mercifully know, but it meant I didn't drink, because I'd sat down to have a beer in like late afternoon, and my eyes immediately went, and I was like, can't do that. But yeah, it had Sparta. I think Steve put it in the WhatsApp group. It had like Sparta 2, Liverpool 0 written all over it. That, so yeah, massively not. But anyway, that's the
second part of the podcast done.
Yeah, there you go. Fucking hell. If you want to see that happen though, and see the absolute pain etched across my face, it's on my YouTube channel now. Couple of bits to cover on the pod. Dan, you on this one. Michael Edwards. Not quite. Here we go.
Close. Imminent, I think, is the word getting banded about at the moment, along with his mate, Richard Hughes, who they came across each other's paths, I think, during Richard Hughes' time at Portsmouth, when Edwards was working as performance analyst. No, not quite.
Analyst.
Analyst, yeah, we'll get there. Yeah, interesting one. I'm really pleased with the reappointments of Michael Edwards, albeit to a higher role than the one he previously held at the football club, obviously sporting director. And I think it's really interesting how FSG have been so determined to get back to the football club. Obviously, they need somebody they can trust implicitly with Jurgen Klopp leaving. And I think they just see Michael Edwards as being that guy. And he's very much the gold standard in his sphere and what he does. Obviously, as I say, he's going to be having an even broader look everything Liverpool Football Club, football operations wise, which would be fascinating. I think he's given a bit of the keys to the FSG as well, but certainly the keys to Anfield and the keys to Liverpool Football Club, with an input on every single decision, which is going to be fascinating. And yeah, I'm really pleased, because obviously, as we know, you know, he was very much heralded as one of the visionaries behind the very successful period during the last few years. So I'm made up. I think he's a very smart man, bit of a genius when it comes to making these types of decisions. So yeah, as for Richard Hughes, as sporting director underneath him, his track record's an interesting one. Obviously, been at Bournemouth. I mean,
Michael Edwards rinsed him a few times, to be fair.
Yeah, which is interesting. Yeah. Interesting 4D chess going on there, because Brad Smith, Jordan Ibe, Dom Solanke. Dom Solanke's come good more recently, you'd have to say, but the other two, a lot of money, you know, way over the odds, you'd have to say. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. But I think, by and large, Richard Hughes done a decent job down at Bournemouth. So, yeah, listen, As for Liverpool and what it means for us and sort of getting our ducks in a row and structure-wise, I'm really pleased. Because I think getting somebody who knows the football club, yes, who knows what we're all about, knows the model, was very much at the forefront of what we've done in recent years, in Michael Edwards back, is can only be seen as a positive. And likewise, getting a sporting director in is really, really important because, as we know, we're not going to put a manager before that's done. So there's that to sort out. There's transfers coming on the horizon, contracts coming on the horizon as well. So ultimately, no matter what it looks like, I think the personnel are really good, but the fact we're sorting it is the most important thing, really.
It feels like you're taking this huge figure out, Chris, in Jurgen Klopp, and putting the power kind of where it should be for the FSG model is they put it above, you know. And actually, with the beautiful thing about it, if it is ultimately Michael Edwards, is this continuity thing that Dan mentions there. You know, we've lost this idea of the boot room type mentality, but actually, what the boot room was a thorough, you know, fair collective of knowledge or whatever that understood the values of the football club and all that kind of stuff. In the modern football world, actually, it's not the worst thing to have that at, you know, a tier or two above coaching level and what have you. So I don't know, I feel quite I'm more reassured at this because you're getting more of a sure thing. You're not just getting a new CEO who doesn't know the football club inside and out, or you're not just getting a new director of football and getting a new manager. He understands the methods of working, which should allow us to carry on doing similar things to what we've done.
Yeah, and I think, again, listen, over the years, FSG have been heavily criticised for different things, and I think rightfully so. But most of the time, they've actually climbed down and, you know, made an apology or changed the way that they've done something in a situation. We all know the big ones that I'm talking about, of course. This actually feels, in some ways, exactly the same, because going back to Michael Edwards and giving him more power and more control is a climb down and an admission that actually we probably made the wrong decision at the time. And now we want to make the right decision. And I understand why more power was given to Jurgen Klopp. And of course, I backed that because he was a visionary and he's unbelievable. But now we're getting back to, you know, what FSG's idea of what Liverpool should be. This is more the core dream. And now I think this sets us up for a golden era even more so, because now I don't think you can get into a position where the manager becomes the all-seeing, powerful figure at the football club, because you have to at some point take it away. And you're right to reference the boot room, but football was a different game back then. You know, there wasn't as much for a manager to do. Now then, a manager could do everything at the football club because it was just running 14 players and putting them on a tactics and watching a few scouts. That's not what a football thing is. You need a coach, because to compete at the top, your coach has to know everything about the opposition and everything about what's coming up in 5 game times. That you can't be having them think about everything that is entailed to run a football club anymore. So the coach needs to be perfect just to compete with Pep Guardiola and Manchester City. So take as much off his plate as possible.
The managers need to come in and take everything off Jurgen Klopp's plate.
No, he needs to come in and coach the frigging side the way that he wants to do it, and that should be enough. You give him the pieces, and if you've got the right guy, and I believe that Liverpool have got the right guy, and, you know, as Dan says, they met at Portsmouth when he was a performance analyst, and Richard Hughes was a player for Portsmouth.
I did not say that. I couldn't get that word out. Love no money.
Richard Hughes was a player at the time, wasn't he? So they've had this 20-year relationship, and they've done dealings with each other in the room. So when you're having a conversation with someone in the room like that, you might have rinsed him, but you might actually also respect how good
he goes about his business.
And they've had a friendship, they've met at conferences and all this type of stuff over the years, so we know that we think that working relationship is going to be excellent. But also we know that what Michael Edwards is doing, and I don't think he's going to have to undo any of the work over the last 2 years, so he should be able to come in and hit the ground running. And then because of his work with Ludonautics and all that with Ian Graham, you probably find that gets involved as well in some point.
You might end up with Ian Graham back involved in some
point. There's a point where Michael Edwards wasn't focused on being a sporting director, he was focused on this company. I think the rules for him and Graham will have changed. And actually we're getting the next evolution of what they are doing in their business and selling that as a consultancy to Liverpool. So we're again ahead of the curve one more time. And I think it'll show by the deal that's done. If he gets a cut in FSG, then I think you know that they believe what he is doing is the next 10 years of football.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting, because this is why you say, like, you get investors in business and people look at it and go, investors, or someone's going to give me £50,000 and then they'll get a little bit out. You can do that. There's two ways to get investors in a company. The better way to do it is a bit of that, but actually someone who brings in skills or other opens avenues into other things. And they've done this with the investments already. And there's the conversations of people we've had with who Liverpool are looking to try and bring. It's more like on the media side, how do you grow Liverpool's media empire and all these kind of things. You're effectively buying Michael Edwards, but you're buying his company. You know he has access. He's got another company that he wants to be a leader in the field of more data and analysis.
Here we go.
Analyst.
Well, that's the problem with them words, isn't it? The first four letters are problematic, so you've got to get it right. You've got to be really careful. Yeah. Treacherous, I'm describing it as.
Yeah, but no, I like the look of it. And again, we're his own entity, and I think most of us would have had him preferred he stuck around in the first instance. But Mike Gordon, clearly, as much as Jürgen Klopp's run out of energy, Mike Gordon's clearly done it. He's had his time with Liverpool. He's had a good time with it. He wanted to step away. He's had to come back to sort this. Looks like Edwards is just going to basically take over his role at the football club as the go-between, you know, between what is FSG and what is Liverpool Football Club. Mm. And then let's see what goes on underneath it. Great. Right. Very quickly, Prague again. This time, I could walk the ground, which makes a massive difference.
Oh, God. I'm not going with you to Prague. Something's going to go terribly wrong.
Yeah.
Are you anywhere on Wednesday this week?
No. Jaden Dans FC again, anyone?
Provided he's got over his concussion, I'll be Jaden Dans FC ultimately, yeah.
Well, this bit, because we did this last week where we sat here and we were like, you know, how strong does he go for the Prague away game? And some of us were more bullish and some were less bullish than others about what 11 should be picked.
I think if you remember, I said I would pick absolutely nobody, but I think Jürgen will go stronger than everyone thinks.
Exactly, yeah. And so I think it's a similar conversation here. I just don't think that you need to keep things going. You need to keep the plate spinning, Chloe, but at the same time, no one's going to risk anything. Mo Salah needs minutes. Szoboszlai needs minutes. Yeah. Nunes needs minutes. Robertson needs minutes. There's actually some really good lads who need to play some more football to get themselves sharp for United at the weekend. So it's another one where there'll be a surprising number, I think, of really good lads in this, but not for 90 minutes.
Yeah, no. In fact, I'd probably bring them on and give them 30 instead of starting them and making them go 45 or 60, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, we saw the likes of Salah the other day. I mean, if there's anybody at all, don't have him anywhere near my football pitch, but I feel like he does need more minutes in the tank just to get that sharpness back. But yeah, like you said there, the players you have mentioned who need to come back in, I mean, Robertson hasn't looked sharp since he's came back into the fold. Szobo still needs to, you know, kick on. I'd be looking at giving them 30. I just don't want to risk anyone, to be perfectly honest. I'm Kids FC this week again, and you know, bring in a couple of lads if we need. The centre back situation's a bit mad because I'm having some kid who I've never heard of. He was on the bench.
Marvin Allo.
No idea what he plays like, but he is one of my centre halves.
I had no idea.
Today.
I'd not seen the bench, and I saw this lad warming up, and I was like, he's a big lad, isn't he? He was really tall. The toy standing next to people was like, is one of our academy lads had like a mad growth spurt? I had no idea who he was. And yeah, he might get a little signed
in the summer from West Ham. Decent, plays left-sided, centre-half predominantly for the 21s and the unders. He's actually still eligible for the 18s, I think I'm right in saying. But that's the difference. I mentioned a few times on his podcast that the drop age-wise, it kind of goes Jarrell Quansah at like 20 to 16-year-old, essentially. Nalo's only recently turned 17. So yeah, it'd be interesting. He's clearly in the round. He's very highly regarded. I've seen him play quite a few times. He's very dominant in the air. He's a defender's defender. He'll win balls. He'll put tackles in. He's hard working, you know what I mean? So I like him. And I'd be very tempted to be playing him. I'd have Jarrell Quansah, as mental as it sounds, as the senior statesman back there. I would partner with Manalo because I think, you know, Konate's not going to be ready for it anywhere, wouldn't be putting anywhere near this game regardless. Van Dijk, as much as Van Dijk has very much been doing this captain thing that you often speak about, Paul, in playing the games you don't expect him to, I think 5-1 up against Sparta Prague is one too many, personally, But listen, it's going to be interesting. I was quite strong in my predicted 11 ahead of the first leg with the thought process of doing what we did, getting the job done, essentially 5-1 away from home. So therefore, that allows me now to be very weak or very under strength, put it this way, on Thursday night.
You can put loads of, like, Virgin that can be on the bench if you want. Yeah. It's at Anfield, so I'd do that. just in case, you know, everything hits the fan.
Well, not as part of things hitting the fan. It's one of them where go and win the game. You know, go and get. I think you put a decent side out, and this won't be super strong, by the way, but it'll have a handful of good lads in. Go 1-0 up, and then do what you want. Make mass changes at half time. You know, whatever. But you've got people turning up to watch this game, and we're so much better when we have a midweek game. You know what I mean? We just keep people going and keep people ticking over. But you can make 5 subs, and you can just bring off all of your good lads. You know, the side you could start Salah, Sobers, like. Pick another one, Darwin, Bradley or Gomez or whatever.
I think Simicast might start, maybe left back.
Maybe.
Get McConnell, Bobby Clark. I've seen a little bit of him in recent days. Obviously, I'm not sure. I'd be tempted to give a lot of the lads in need of minutes the final 30 if possible.
You don't want to give Prague anything. Do you know what I mean? You don't want to give them a sniff because they'll just throw the kitchen sink at it, because why not? It's a big away day at Liverpool. You put a good side out to start that and let them know, well, yeah, it's all right. No, we're not fucking around. You get a goal and then it's done. It's already basically done. They need 5 goals to knock us out at this point. But if you get another one in the first half, you've got 45 minutes then to score 6 goals to get yourself in that situation. Yeah, fine. Adrian in goal.
No, that's maybe one step too far for me.
Right, okay, we're going to wrap that up there. We've gone well over time. But yeah, Man City, Liverpool, massive game of football. So many good feelings off the back of it, so why not? We're going to be talking about the other incidents around the Premier League. Come and join us over on the Biased Football Show over on RedmenPlus.com. We're going to talk about Arsenal, we're going to talk about Man United and Everton, and we're going to look ahead to the FA Cup games at the weekend as well. See you there.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.